Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivera, your unscripted small business and SEO podcast host. I'm here with Paul Pape, who is going to introduce himself and tell us why we should trust him to lead our party through the adventure that is digital marketing.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeremy. I appreciate that. My name is Paul Pape, and I am the barkeep and game master for Gamify Business, in which I basically take the idea of business, I convert it into a role-playing game for you to play and actually learn and strive for success through. It is all RPG-based gaming themed, and so everything that you would encounter in real life, in real business, I have converted into the monsters and encounters that you would encounter in an RPG to make it more fun, to make you want to actually get out there and actually do the work that entrepreneurs like to avoid.
Sick. That's the interview right there. Sick. Interview done. I think we captured it. Put a pin in. No, I need to ask a few more questions. I love Dimension 20. I'm a big fan of that whole crew, and I'm wondering, is your experience with D&D something that's, you know, was homebrew? Did that experience come from watching others get successful in this niche? Because obviously I know how much it takes to create a brand identity and to also like take the steps to adapt a different medium into the training material for something else also is challenging. It just shows that you probably have a lot of experience as a DM or with DM. So what does that history look like?
So I was a big D&D nerd growing up. I took a break from it for a while, but I love my RPG games. That's never left me. And the actual impetus for doing it as a business, as a role-playing game, actually came from a client who was really stuck in understanding business processes, but was a huge gaming nerd. And so I was trying to find a common ground for us. And so I was meeting him face to face. It was a couple days in a row. And I said, well, let me come back tomorrow. And what I'm going to do is we're going to actually play D&D business edition. And I was just spitballing, just kind of running it off the top of my head. And I was like, instead of playing characters like a wizard or a warrior, we're actually going to play your role in the business. And instead of traditional monsters like dragons and ghouls, we're actually going to encounter monsters that would be obstacles that you'd encounter in real business. And we ended up playing that for about 4 hours. And when we got done with it, the CEO of the company, there was a few of them there, a few company members, but the CEO turned to me and goes, is this what business is? Because if it is, I think I finally understand it and it seems fun. And that was the light bulb moment that I was like, okay, I think we got something here. Because we all play games ever since we were a kid. Even if you don't play Dungeons and Dragons or any like traditional tabletop role play game, that's fine. You've played other games. I mean, heck, we've all played Candyland or something like that. You understand that there are specific rules and parameters that you have to work around inside of a game to be able to be successful at it. Well, business is no different. But the problem is nobody defines the rules. You can go to get an MBA and you can be told all these different rules and settings and everything else to try to prime you for this. But the reality is you're going to kind of have to make it up on your own, like a role-playing game, like a DM. And so what I do is I come in and I set the parameters based around your business. It's all customized. It's not one size fits all. It never is. And then basically within that, I play the game master for a while until you get your feet wet enough that you're like, I think I understand this. And you can take over the campaign yourself.
People delivering chunks of concrete fences in Florida, people replacing drywall as a general contractor, people, you know, installing air monitors. They're very hands-on. Do you think that this still is an experience, you know, for a home service-based business that's worthwhile?
It really depends on where you're stuck. See, I come in here and I'm not here to set up your business. Typically, the people that I work with are already doing business. The problem is that they get into the business because they want to do a specific thing. That's what we all do when we're entrepreneurs, depending, you know, even if you're installing air monitors versus, you know, sculpting things for clients. We all get into it because there's something that we're interested in doing and we want to pursue it. The thing is then we follow that passion. We get some clients here and there. We're out there advertising the way everybody else advertises, but then we kind of get lost in everything else that we're supposed to do. We don't have a direction. And so typically when people come to find me, they're at a position where they're like, I'm kind of a little lost. I'd like some direction. And so that would be where the campaign comes in. So for somebody who is setting up air monitoring systems or putting in fencing, would I say that, you know, getting their crew together to sit down and campaign out like a couple of different ideas, is that going to be like super helpful for them? Not in the actual fence building part. No, because they already know what they're doing there. But when it comes to the actual business, when we come to marketing, when we come to, you know, making sure that we stay focused on the task ahead, that we're not trying to branch out to do too many things. Those types of areas, that is where it comes in. If you're unsure of how to advertise, if you're unsure, you know, like, where are my clients at? This kind of thing. That's where it comes in. It's using more of the creative and animation or creative and imagination side of things to keep the momentum going. Also, because when we're doing business, especially if you're doing something that is manual labor, it's repetitive, it's boring over time, you need something to keep it fresh and interesting. So we do a lot of, for people, especially in that, we do a lot of quests with rewards built into it. So they're short-term quests that then have a reward that everybody gets to partake in. The better that the quest is done, the better the reward that is given.
Cardboard board games versus RPG.
Oh, man, I love them both, but I love the imagination that goes into an RPG. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'll play pretty much anything anybody puts in front of me, but I know, like, the people that I play with, their eyes glaze over once the rule book comes out, and we're like, here's the 400 pieces that we have to play with. They're like, yeah, I'm out. Can we play some gin rummy? You know, it's like they get bored with it. But I've got a select few friends where we're like, oh, look at this thing came out. It's got all these pieces, all these rules, all this complexity to it. I'm down for that. But getting those people together with the people that I typically are with, it's not going to, they're going to collide. It's two nerddoms that do not go together. So I would say for the majority of things, RPG works out better because everybody can sit and just use their imagination.
Give me your foundation of business, consulting and marketing and direction. Why do you think you know enough about businesses to turn it into a game system as your consulting process?
Wow, that's a fun question. It's like, prove your authority, Paul. No, it's actually a great question. So I am a freelance designer. I was actually talking to my wife about this just the other day. It's like, I have not applied for a job since I was 15 years old. Everything that I've done has been freelance. I've found the work myself. I've run a very successful art and design company for over 20 years. I spent 6 years on Twitch, on that platform, the live platform, not gaming. I was actually doing art, and I would do it for 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. And during that, I'm having conversations where I'm performing the job that I normally have, which is the Santa for Nerds artwork that I was doing. But then from that, I would be consulting and coaching a lot of other creatives who are like, how are you successful? What are the steps that I need to do? How do I figure out what to charge? Where do I find out? It's all the same questions. And so basically from that, I was giving them generic business advice, you know, the business advice we all get, and trying to move that needle forward. And what I found is that the majority of them either didn't get it or they didn't want to do it because it sounded boring or too difficult. And so when I started branching out to become an actual coach and consultant, I was like, okay, so I'm going to have to use my own lived experience, obviously. And, you know, I've hired coaches, I've hired all these people to help me as well so that I can learn this process a bit better. But what I found is that we're all talking same generic stuff, and that's not really resonating with creatives, the people that I actually truly want to help. And so that's why I had to go back to my 20 years of working in a completely custom designed business where I don't carry a product line. Everything that I make is custom one-offs, and it works for the person. And I was like, well, how can I take that experience and actually turn it into a coaching or consulting business that actually resonates with the client? And I think that's where the expertise comes in, because I can come in there and I'm adjustable. I can go with the flow with whatever it is. So if we have a sit down, have a conversation, and you are a fence builder, and then next week I'm working with a painter, I have enough experience in both of those, and I'm used to working off the cuff enough that allows me to basically hone the package towards that individual.
Tell me about neurotypicals versus autism versus ADHD? And have you done consultations with people who you're like, okay, this person's a 100% normie brain person versus you talk to somebody and you're like, I love you, but you got a touch of the tism, as my wife loves to say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have ADD. My son has ADHD. My son almost qualified for the tism spectrum, but he's very personable. So it's like, you're like, that doesn't work. Well, that's why it's a spectrum. I would say half of my clients are actually neurospicy, as I like to call them, as opposed to neurotypical. When I deal with people, I put them into two categories, and they're fairly easy to figure out when I'm talking to you. There are linear thinkers, and there are cloud thinkers. Neurospicy are cloud thinkers. The neurotypicals are linear thinkers. Everything's got a process. And so with what I do, it works okay for the linear thinkers, but so does regular business plans. I mean, they can follow a task from A to Z. Cloud thinkers are A, B, G, squirrel, clouds, grass, you know the thing. And so it's trying to figure out how to keep them invested and moving forward is the challenge there. But you know, I got it as well. So all of the books that I've written are actually built with that in mind. A neurotypical person can pick up the book, go through it, and they're like, well, this is kind of jumping all over the place. It's linear, but the processes that I'm asking you to go through, it's like, well, sometimes I'm going to fill in a blank. Sometimes I'm going to have to do like circles. Sometimes I'm going to have to roll some dice. There's always something different going on. That's for the neurospicy folk, because I know that they get bored really easily. I mean, trying to corral my 19-year-old who wants to do everything to like focus on something without getting angry and be like, pay attention. You know, you've got to be able to understand that. And I think, you know, raising him from little and then experiencing that and then actually seeing the reflection of myself in him, I was like, oh, okay, I get it now. So I think that's a lot of it. So you either fall into one of the two categories in my perception of things. Now I do, everybody who comes to me, they actually take a quiz. It's on my website, which is gamifybusiness.com/quiz. And it's a personality test, but for business and how you actually apply it. There's six different categories that you can fall into. And I can tell you pretty much right off the bat everything I need to know about you by which category you fall into. And we do that in trade shows. We actually have them do it. And they come up and they show me the card and I'll tell them all about themselves. And then they just look at me and they're like, hey, man, you nailed me. It's like, yeah, that's the idea. And there's neurotypicals and there are neurospices in that group. And I know how you're going to react to things just by the card.
I'm going to lob a softball for you. Like I asked Matt Brooks of SEOteric, why can't I just ask Claude to make a D&D scenario for my business and do the same thing as you?
Yeah, you could. It will be crap. But I mean, don't get me wrong. I use Claude. I literally was just working on Claude this morning before I came over here to do the podcast. I love the AI as a tool, but you have to understand that people aren't tools. They can be tools, but they're not tools. And so typically what we want to do is we want to, there has to be a level of customization and creativity that you put into the RPG. Can it give you some generics? Absolutely. But is it going to be something that you're going to want to follow through and because it's geared towards you? No. It doesn't matter how much you put into Claude or any other AI agent to even like say, this is who I am and all this, because it's just going to parrot back what you've given them, the information, or it's going to pull from the internet and it's going to give you generics. And that's really the problem that we run into with using AI is we think it's this universal thing that's going to solve our problems. And the reality is it's just another tool. It's a hammer. It's a paintbrush. It's a really well thought out machine, but it only can give you what you put in, regardless of whether or not you have the entire internet's birth of knowledge to pull from. It doesn't matter. You're still going to get this parroting. And so while you could do it, it's not going to be as well executed as somebody who's creative, who actually sat down and thinks it out and then helps to plan it out for your specific campaign.
Hot take. What if you were standing on a soapbox, would you, based off of your experience in consulting, tell these small business owners, stop doing this.
Stop trying to please everybody. Stop it. Knock it off. As soon as you try to appeal to everyone, you gray yourself out. The idea is that you want to do something that you found passion within. And then we're going to go and put that out into the world as your message. This is, or your product or whatever it is that you're putting out there. The thing is that's not going to appeal to everybody. Just not. And we got to get over that. Social media has trained us, though, to think that everything that we put out on social media or out into the world should be loved by millions. It should always go viral, or we should be aiming for it going viral. But the reality is no, we shouldn't. Stay in your lane. Niche down. Riches are in the niches, is what they say. You know, so it's like really stay with the thing that made you passionate and then find those people. Because if you stay true to the passion that you have, the people that you, the customers, the people that you are imploring to are going to be like super fans. They're going to be like, this person truly, utterly speaks to me, and it doesn't feel all grayed out. So that'd be the thing that I'd shout.
100% agree. Jules Novkova, who I interviewed yesterday, episode probably will be out by the time that yours comes out. She had an interesting take. I'm curious if you agree that the most successful businesses really are leveraging empathy, because whoever is going to pay them is paying them to solve or empathize with the problem that they're facing.
That's a really good take on that. The answer is 100% agree. It's a really nice way of framing that. And every business, every product is there to solve a problem for a person. But, you know, we can go to Walmart, Target, whatever, and just walk down the shelves and find solutions to everything that we're looking for. But it's not going to be, there's no empathy in that. That's just a solution that we have to provide the empathy for. When you're working with a consultant or a coach, that is their main role. I was literally talking to my therapist yesterday, and he's like, your job is like therapy for business. I'm like, it's really what it is. You know, you sit down and you talk to these people who are in a, nobody comes to you as a consultant or a coach if they're really successful. Like, they come to you when the shit's hitting the fan, really is what happens. Or they're confused. They're in a state of needing help. They need assistance. And so absolutely, you have to really, now don't get me wrong, there are definitely coaches and consultants, and I've hired a couple of them that don't give it, they don't care. They really don't. And they will basically just try to shoehorn you into this package that they made because that's what they're selling. They don't care about it outside of that. Or what they'll do is they'll do the opposite. Instead of going empathy, they go to manipulation, which is, tell me all of your fears, all of the things that make you upset. And then I'm going to utilize that to keep you on the hook, to keep you paying more. And I'm not a fan of that either. So, yeah, the person you interviewed, 100%, that's the right course that you should be going down, the empathy route, to actually help and want to do that. And that's honestly why I do the barkeep, is because the barkeep is a position of service instead of a position of power or leadership. So when you come to me and I'm the barkeep, I'm here to, you know, run your game. Basically, I'm just letting you know, I'm here as service to you. I am not here to lead or to make you do what I say. I want to help you to understand what it is that you're trying to get through. So the empathy plays very much into that role.
This question comes from another interview, Timothy, he's got an agency in Nashville, marketing agency. And this is speaking business owner to business owner, marketing consultant to consultant. What's your own personal pain point in your business that's been the most difficult to solve? Have you solved it? If so, how? If not, would you like some help? Like, because I can ask my next guest and see if they have some wisdom to fix your squeaky wheel, or you might have some grease for another consultant's challenge, marketing.
I think that the answer to that is a tricky one. It's like, do I have a pain point? Absolutely. And I think we all have the same one. For me right now, currently, my biggest pain point is that I've created something that is new and nobody knows about. And so how do I get the word out there? What I do is so specific that if I say it's gamifying business, I get either the, I don't want to play games, I'm taking this seriously. Or it's like, I'm not a big gamer, this is not for me. And it's like, no, it's got a good universal feel to it. So like putting it on a business card doesn't work. Throwing it up onto an ad on the side of Google doesn't work. So for me, the biggest pain point that I have is finding the customers that I want. A lot of people have the same problem. Have I solved it? I thought I did, and then it was earlier this week where I'm like, I have not solved this. I spent a lot of time, probably about 18 months building authority because I was doing creative work. I was basically an artist and a fabricator for 20 years. And so everything about me online is very much about fabrication and design. And now I'm like, well, now I'm going to be a consultant and a coach. So, okay, so let me go. I got to put out the authority that I'm that guy who can do that. And so I spent a lot of time putting, you know, hundreds of podcasts, lots of posts, going out and doing speaking events, TED Talks, all this stuff to prove that I'm the authority that I am so that you can trust me. The problem is that now I've built an authority machine and not a getting customers machine. And so I'm fighting that right now. It's like, how do I find the customers in this? How do I bring it back from just being the authority machine to being something that finds the customers? So I haven't figured it. I haven't cracked that one yet. So, and that's some honest tea from a guy who's in the machine right now. So, yeah.
Honestly, I feel that because there with the changes in Google, in my industry, we're very much being pushed towards you must have a brand, you must build that brand. But there's also like this other side of it of the steps and things that you do to build brand aren't necessarily a client acquisition. They're secondary too, and it's useful for Google to help sort you into a bucket of like, I can trust you, I can't trust you. And the side flow off of that is supposed to be, oh, you're trustworthy now, your stuff will rank for stuff that you're relevant to, and the rest will fall into place and you'll convert them and they'll follow. But you're right that there is necessarily kind of a different mode to it of like, you know, if you think about traditional advertising, you literally have a toggle on Meta of like, is your objective to gain followers and to get more likes or and engagement, or are you trying to get conversions? And, you know, your ad spend, your budget allocation is now bifurcated between those two of, you know, am I building authority and visibility and brand, which is supposed to, and I it's hard to like truly trust like, yeah, I know if I build a brand, that is an integral piece of the puzzle, but it's not the same piece as actually like driving, spending the ads to get the actual booked consult. They're different, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So what's... what would you say is the number one handhold that small businesses should be looking towards to grab onto as a first step towards improving their business? Aside from obviously contacting you, little pitch there for you, but it's a softball. Aside from like, you know, scheduling right now and booking with your business.
what's something they could do? Yeah, honestly, I love this analogy, so I'll just spell it out for you here. So typically when a person wants to become an entrepreneur there or a small business and they want to be successful, they're launching something, they are in pursuit of either and or fame and fortune. Okay, we want either of those two. The problem is fame and fortune are two dragons that are very fast, and the only way to really catch them is to strip away everything that you are to be able to become as fast as them. So by the time you catch them, you're no longer who you were. So what I tell people is that first handhold is ride the dragon of passion. Find the thing that you were really passionate about in the first place and just hang on to that, because everything branches off of that. If you want to be an influencer, what are you influencing about? The thing that you're passionate about. Become that person that rides the dragon of passion, and then the dragons of fame and fortune follow behind you. So that's really the first handhold that I'd say is, if you find yourself and you're like, I'm not finding the customers, or I'm not doing this, I can literally come into your business and go, let me see what you're advertising. Let me see what you're marketing out to other people. And what I typically find is that they've grayed out. They're no longer following that thread that they were doing because they felt that, oh, I wasn't getting the traction that I needed immediately. So now I'm going to branch out and just kind of grab everything so I don't drown in debt or the business goes under. But then by the time they do that, they're holding all this stuff and they're no longer who they are. And so they need to strip away all of that stuff and then really focus on that passion again.
I love that, because it also kind of fits into the other problem that I've discussed several times of the inherent inauthenticity of marketing versus the requirement of I'd say modern social media, a lot of modern marketing, it's all about quote unquote being authentic. And so you're authentically, you know, putting on a song and dance, but how do you do that while remaining true to yourself?
Yeah, it's a difficult balancing act, because, and honestly, I think the answer is one that nobody wants to do, which is show the messy middle. Show that you can screw up, but you can recover from it. Show that not everything is beautiful, because we have trained social media to only show perfection. And it, you know, and it affects everything from preteen kids all the way up to adults in the retirement. They're like, everything seems so glossy and perfect. But the reality is you're seeing 2% of someone's 100% life. There's 98% of screwing up in there, looking like hell, you know, like dragging yourself back to work because you just aren't feeling it today. Those kind of things. That messy middle actually grounds you as a business. If I'm, you know, I have two books here. And so you said I could pitch. So I'm going to do them here. So one of them is Quit Selling Your Shit. And what that is product first selling kills creative based businesses. Every entrepreneur is a creative based business. The thing is we start putting it out there and we're just selling the thing all the time. What happens is you remove the person from it. And as a creative, you really want to focus on yourself. So quit selling your shit, sell yourself. So the other book that goes with it is The Bard's Guide to Storycraft. Because if you go out there and tell a convincing story about the business, you don't even have to pitch the product. People like basically understand. So we used to sit around campfires as cavemen and tell stories about things. And it's the same thing now with marketing. Think about Budweiser, Clydesdales. They don't sell beer. They sell horses and puppy dogs. But we all know exactly what it is. And it pulls on the heartstring. It's telling a story. You know, if you think back to any of the major advertising campaigns that were really popular, Santa Claus and polar bears for Coca-Cola, the Noid for Domino's Pizza, all of these things, they are telling a story. And then we relate to that. There is the Yokiro Taco Bell Chihuahua, you know, all these little things have nothing to do with the product, but it has something to do about storytelling. And so they quit trying to put this, they're quit trying to sell their shit, and they're now selling themselves, the business. And that's really what we should be trying to do more and more of.
What about scale? So my wife asks, you know, what's the biggest problem in our society? Like, why are so many things going wrong? If things are as utopian as I claim to be, I tend to be very optimistic. And I thought about it and I thought, I think that a lot of the problems in our society come from scale.
Mm.
Yeah. Because they lose the individuality. They, you know, lock masses into stereotypes. When you're a small business, you can, you know, plan the end of your business and put into your rules and regulations, hey, don't be evil. But then you become Google and you cross out that line of don't be evil from your about page. And, you know, your business scales up and you lose touch with it. It's also that authenticity that we touched on. It's also much harder to do and maintain with your business. You know, it's easy as a roofer and you got a crew of three or four. Like, hey, you know, Bone Dry Roofing. I interviewed them and they're like, we care. Every time, that's what we tell our folk when we go out. Somebody says something, you're paying attention and you show that you care. And we drive that home. Well, you got a multinational, you know, roofing corp. It's hard to project that material. Like, you can have your training orientation webinar and say, we at Whalen Brand, we care. So would you agree that scale be the enemy of creativity?
Yes. Yes. And I hate to blanket statement anything or to be so succinct in that one, but the answer is yes, because when you start to scale, you lose control. You start, like, think about when you start a small business, it's you typically, and then you might hire a few people on, but you've got your hand in a lot of the pies. And if not, you've got direct oversight. When you start to scale up, what happens is you have to start hiring more people to hire more people to oversee more people. And it's, you start to lose it. So the person sitting in the boardroom is so out of touch with the person on the floor. And that's why shows like Undercover Boss are so successful, because that guy has no idea what's happening in his business. So he goes and acts as one of the business people for a week. And he's like, this is all messed up. It's like, this is your business. Like, you are so out of touch with what you're actually doing. They've lost the thread. But I was talking to a wonderful lady the other day. Her name is Diana. Is on her podcast. And we were talking about this exact same issue. And she asked me, is it necessary to scale to be successful? And I sat with them for a while. And I think I had a glib answer on the podcast or whatever. But the longer I sit with it, the answer that comes to me is no. You don't need to scale to be successful. And I use this analogy with a lot of my clients and a lot of the podcasts that I'm on. It's called the rule of 100. And if you did some research on me, you've probably run across that. But the rule of 100 states that you don't need 1 million purchasers right now. 100 makes you successful. 100 consistent people buying from you will make you successful to a point of comfort. Will you be a millionaire? Probably not. But the vast majority of the world are not millionaires, but the vast majority of people are comfortable. And that's really what you're after. If we think back before the internet, before all of that stuff happened, and you go back to any small town or even a large town, they would advertise in the yellow pages, you know, but they had a brick and mortar. And if 1 million people, if 1,000 people showed up one day to become viral and walk through the door of a mom and pop shop, it would destroy that business. There's no way for them to deal with that scale. Whereas like Walmarts and stuff like that, yeah, they're made for that. But we also know all the horror stories that go with the Walmarts and stuff and how that destroys these smaller businesses. But that mom and pop store can be around for 60, 70, 80 years and be really successful dealing with 100 people a day. 50 people a day, you know, that consistency. So do you need to scale to be successful? I don't think so. But it really depends on what your motivation is. If you want to be a millionaire, you know, scale away. You're going to lose your soul in the process, but scale away. But I think if you want to be happy and be successful, you don't need to do it.
I think the best example I have is a real life one from John Henshaw, who owned Raven Tools, a very popular SEO tool, you know, equal to Moz, as popular as Ahrefs in its day. And, you know, when I worked there, you know, he and the other two founders made sure that it was run as a lifestyle business, that everybody, when we came in, we had a sense of community, we connected, we had a shared mission for what we were growing. We all cared about our different domains. We all brought our different ideas. And the pay was great. When I remember he asked me during the interview how much salary I wanted, and I told him a number. He's like, no, you want 20,000 more than that. And I'm like, I want 20,000 more than that. He's like, yeah, okay. And we'll move you out here to Tennessee. And he changed my life. He paid for my wife's surgery because his insurance refused to cover. You know, she got gastric bypass, but when she was pregnant, it slipped. And because of the coding, all gastric surgeries are coded as voluntary, despite the fact that it was killing her. So they paid out of pocket to save her life. And that all came from that, you know, lifestyle business aspect and approach. And I came back when he had sold the company to a larger corporation. And, you know, I spent the next 5 years doing product management and SEO for an entity that didn't understand the original brand. And for, you know, they didn't allocate the resources, and they, you know, we moved from where we were to a second office. And in that process, we sold all of the extra stuff. And then we only had 5 people and 5 desks. And then we had 3 people and then more people. It was just this slow extraction of all everything. All of the talent was gone. Like, just the core basic software was still remained. And even that, you know, my job was literally to create a version of that software onto their main platform. So my job was literally to suck out the life of the cash cow of this lifestyle business to another business, and they they were growing aggressively and they took on investors. And then those investors came due after, you know, 2 or 3 years, and they made us compromise and made us focus on our business plan of where that money needed to go. So, you know, I have that example, real life example, lived example of, hey, you can build a lifestyle business. You don't to have an incredible amount of success, respect in the industry, a fantastic product, loyal followers. You don't have to become Walmart. You don't have to become Bezos. You know, you can do something, you know, successful that isn't scaled to heaven. You know, one of my interviewees, Lorraine Ball, she's like, I intentionally don't grow past a certain number of people in my company, even though I could take on more clients, because I've had that big fish. You know, I had a giant whale come in, and we added a bunch of people to the boat just to, and then our business became theirs. We were just a department, and we no longer had a true consulting business because everything was for one client. And our second, you know, we started to diminish and not be able to provide for the people that we liked working with. We just had to feed the beast. So, like, it was the hardest decision. We lost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars annually, cutting them, letting them go, had to fire people to scale back down and right size, but it was the right decision for us. So, you know, you can do it. It's hard, but I think the world is better for having a more diversified class of small business owners solving problems more creatively than more businesses scaling up and cornering markets.
Yeah, agreed. I think because, again, it's that graying out. When these conglomerates start buying up all these other ones, the product loses its focus. You know, you were very much into this, you know, into this business that was about lifestyle, you know, about treating each other individually, but then you just became another statistic, another number in the cog in the machine, number in the ledger, all that stuff. And yeah, you lose that. But we also then, I mean, it's where we're all at. I remember when cable was like the enemy. And so all these streaming services came out. It's like, oh, no, just watch this cool thing. And then now look where we're at again. We've just now taken all those and they're packaging them all back up. And it's like, we've just reinvented cable. But now it's digital.
Yeah, we've reinvented somehow worse cable, because if you like a show, maybe for Halloween, that Harry Potter moves over to Peacock on a different digital subscription. Oh, it moved over here. I got to have that subscription up. It's a game of shifting shells. And it's, I guess being able to choose what you get to watch is slightly better model than just like, here, these channels are dumping this and maybe this one likes this better. But yeah, that's a problem. We can't solve that in this podcast. I think we're stuck.
We cannot.
If there was a question you had in your mind before you came on the podcast that you would have liked me to have asked, what was it?
That's a good, you know, I get this question a lot on podcasts, and I'm like, usually I've got one that comes right off the bat, but we've had a really good conversation here. And I think we've touched on a lot of the stuff that I would normally do. I have a new TEDx talk coming out in October, and we haven't talked about that one. So I think if there was a question that I wouldn't be asked, is what is this new TED talk about, Paul?
Yeah. What's that new TED talk about that I totally knew about? What's that all about?
Well, I'm glad you asked there, Jeremy. So this TEDx talk is happening in October, and it's my second one. The first one was all about being Santa for nerds, which is the title I have for my other business. But this one is actually about the myth of the starving artist. And what a lot of people don't know is it was created as a joke. It was a joke from a bunch of rich kids who had rich families, and they thought it would be fun to play poor and be poets and just live on the streets. Now, they were never poor because they came from rich people. And so, but they thought it was really interesting. And what happened was that because they made looking poor seem so good, because there was no fear of starvation or living out on the streets because they always just go home. What happened is people started seeing creatives as being something that they could be happy because they're just creating. And so that's all that they need. And then some guy wrote a opera about it called La Boheme. which then eventually just kind of transformed. It became Rent later on in life, where we just celebrate this idea that artists want to be poor because if they make any money, then they're selling out. And the reality is that before all of this happened, before the Industrial Revolution, artists were making bank. Like Mozart had $175,000 a year career, if we win today's terms, you know. Picasso was, you know, millionaire, multi-millionaire. Like they had patrons, they had, the church was supporting them. But then once the Industrial Revolution happened, it switched it all up. It gave birth to brokers for artists. It gave birth to, you know, the basically let's steal your idea or make you become a cog in the machine. And you create the ideas, because if you don't create the ideas first, you will starve to death on the streets, but we'll give you that living. And so that's what the talk is about, is dispelling the starving artist myth.
I love that, because, you know, there's my wife is taking on a tattoo apprenticeship right now. And one of the tattoo artists there in the local studio, she said she's never met anybody who pushes money away faster. Like, he loves his art, but he just has this, like, you know, anti-capitalist, like, I'm an artist and, you know, I'm not necessarily in it for the money. I'm like, okay, but how do you eat? Like, there's a mentality. She's like, it's funny because, like, he does similar tattoos to the other artists in the studio, but somehow his mentality just doesn't attract the opportunity that the others are seeing for themselves.
Well, I mean, as much as I hate this capitalistic world that we live in, this oligarchy that we have of money, what I have found to be very true is if you underprice yourself, you're seen as valueless. And if you price yourself adequately or a little bit high, that hurt on your customers actually makes you more valuable.
Does. I have first person, like when I had two foundational, you know, I was a customer support representative for a website hosting company. So I learned SEO because I kept having to answer that question at my day job of, well, you know, can you move the logo over 2 inches? Yes. Okay. It's nested tables. Takes an hour. And then they would ask, well, how do I rank better on Google? And so I had to learn that. And then, you know, somebody's like, oh, hey, you know, I've got a tailor shop. Can you help me rank? Like, make me a suit and I'll get you to rank number one for Riverside Tailor. Now, he got the better deal because he still ranks number one for Riverside, California Tailor, but my suit no longer fits. that's not on him necessarily, but the second example was like, I priced myself, and I priced it at $200. I ended up doing like 20 hours of worth of work for this website. And, you know, I kicked myself every time I had to log in and like, oh, they had this request for it. I totally underpriced myself because I was underconfident. I was like, it's my first freelance project. I don't know. Oh, gosh. And then, you know, like when I started doing my freelance consulting for real, you know, like I have to ask for a ton more. And then I realized, you know what, I need to ask for even more. And it's goes back to, you know, when I was working at that real estate company, I would see homes, you know, because I lived in California. I'm like, oh, I see homes that are like $40,000 in Tennessee. I'm like, I could actually afford that. So it's part of the context that you're in. And like asking enough is, it's kind of a cultural thing as much as just a wisdom thing. Like, don't underprice yourself, because nobody exploits you worse than your family. Don't. If you are going to have your family pay you, charge them more, almost twice as much as anybody else. Do not give sweetheart deals to your family, and charge everybody more.
So, can I ask you a question?
Absolutely. Turn the tables.
All right. So, because you are also a consultant and you keep raising your prices, where, like, do you feel the hurt of not being able to help the people who can't afford you?
No, because if they're not, I do have a heart for people who, you know, just seriously don't have the money for it. But for what I do, for the service that I provide, which is, you know, search engine optimization and, you know, creating marketing content, you know, doing deep SEO strategy, you know, doing link building through podcasting, creating white label podcasts. What I do, you to do it, you have to have a budget. And I know that any business that's successful enough to need what I do, if they don't pay me enough, then that's a choice.
Mm.
You know, and it's about their business allocation, and that's fine. Like if they don't want to, you know, if they want to spend their budget to bring in the leads on the paid side, then that works. That's a functional model. It leaves money on the table when it comes to search engine optimization, because that's a longer play. It's more organic traffic, long term. You know, you also decrease churn. You have more success with recurring revenue. Those, all of those things, you don't necessarily, you can succeed without it if you are willing to pay more on the upfront advertising side just to get them through the door. So if they're not going to pay my rates, then, you know, they're just not for me. And that's kind of the selection process. And I'm not going, as you call it, gray myself out, because they're not, you know, I think that I've established a really good price point. I get paid well, the results are great, and I've, you know, narrowed down specifically the type of consulting and the type of process that I have to what I really enjoy doing. So that's that passion side of things. And it's, for me, it's become really podcast centric. You know, these human conversations I have here, right, you know, generate unique, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 words worth of unique human relevant content for the industry and niche, which I no longer have to write articles that are 3,000, 4,000 words long, because I can navigate my previous conversations that I've had and bring together marketing content. And I can do the same for another business. You know, I created a unscripted home improvement podcast for my contractor client, because then we can interview, you know, secondary businesses in the community and build links, build visibility, build trust and authority. And not with direct competitors, but I can also talk to home improvement folk. I did one with Rick Haggerty in Nashville, not the same market, does the same thing. And he had fantastic insights about, hey, what's happening in the season? Gold's apparently really, really big thing in residential hardware fixtures this season. So I didn't know that. I added that to the marketing information on the blog, on the site, you know, for, you know, H&H Construction. Built their brand and made their marketing better and made social media posts based off of our interview of him. So it's like, you know, all collaborative. So I'm chasing my passion of these human conversations, turning it into using my, you know, knowledge and expertise. So I'm not afraid to charge what I'm worth.
Okay, good. That's good. That's a good answer. Because I work with I work with two stages of creativity, which is starting out, and then those who are established and need help. The ones who are starting out, historically poor. Again, starving artists.
Yeah.
And so it's like, they need my help. They want my help. They cannot afford my help. And so, but there's no one else offering the same help, you know, specifically that I'm offering. And so it's like, I can't even like send them off to, oh, this person gets you to a place where then you can eventually afford me. And so it's finding that perfect balance of how do I help this smaller group while still honoring myself, what I'm worth, all of that, and still be able to also attract the people that are a little bit more established who can actually pay the fee that I ask for.
One potential is, you know, and it works for every small business at every level, is consider, you know, potential collaboration. You know, if your business might not need 100% of its profitability just from your front end customers, but if you found alignment with other brands that wanted to reach that same audience and had other value options that they also needed but fit different niches, and you could create affiliate partnerships, referral partnerships to pass those on. I have a few key referral partnerships, you know, that over the years, push and pull, whoop and wharf, like I've made twice as much as I would just consulting when I passed on a lead that didn't fit me to somebody else. It fit them better. They had the right engagement, and I got a piece of that. So considering, you know, not just for yourself, augmenting your income by considering secondary channels, you know, you also have that bully pulpit of authority, which can be monetized, you know, with views and advertorials and things like that. So, you know, there's secondary options where you can, you know, make part of it more philanthropic. You can also literally, you know, defer some of the tax costs by setting up your own nonprofit version or outreach or program to augment it. So there are creative solutions that could help you reach those who truly can't afford it by structuring your business with other things in mind. And I think any business really should be looking at those collaborative options. So like the contractors that I work with, I'm like, hey, let's establish, you don't want to do plumbing, you don't do the crawl spaces. Let's get an established referral relationship with two or three crawl space folks, and we'll pad your, you know, bottom line because we get the lead. We're doing extra right. marketing, reaching in, and we make sure that the person we pass them on to is not fly by night. So we've done good and we get paid for it. And that makes it easier for those slimmer months where we're not getting the leads and contracts or where we want or need them to be. But, you know, that's just kind of the more creative side of that business process.
Yeah, that's a great, great follow-up on that. Appreciate it.
Who is interviewing who here? All right. I'm putting on my host hat again. I want you to shout out where you're going to be, how people can best connect with you. Is there a platform, a social media platform, if they are curious, if they want to see like a YouTube video, how does this actually work? What does this look like in practice? How can they best learn more and connect with you, Paul?
They can go find me at gamifybusiness.com. Again, that's G-A-M-I-F-Y business.com. There you can learn about all my books. I also have some books on Amazon. Again, under Gamified Business, so just search that up on Amazon. You can find some books there. On social media, I'm known as Paul Pape Designs because that is the business that's been around for 20 years. No sense in losing all that momentum by switching out the names. So Paul Pape Designs is everywhere. But again, if you just search Gamified Business, I'm everywhere. That's the easiest way to get a hold of me.
Well, I appreciate your time and your inventive attitude. I really like your take on the consulting business. I think it's unique, and I appreciate you stopping in.
Thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.